Hello, and welcome to the Europe at War podcast.
Episode 3.3, the 21st of April. We left off last week's episode with Marshal Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front Forces encamped outside of Berlin, in the town of Bernau, to the northeast of the city, where they were busy resupplying and reinforcing their frontline units in anticipation of their assault on Berlin itself. Well, today, their assault begins. On the morning of the 21st of April, the American and British Air Forces launched their final bombing raids on the city, softening up the German defences one last time before Soviet troops entered Berlin. And once the Red Army entered Berlin, the Americans and British stopped all further raids on the city in order to avoid friendly fire incidents with the incoming Soviets. But if the people of Berlin thought that the halting of British and American air raids signalled the end of the aerial bombardments of their city, then they were cruelly mistaken, as the Red Army Air Force happily took over bombing duties and launched devastating raids on Berlin every day until the city surrendered. The final American and British raids on the city did have one curious impact, however, as these raids seemed to have provided the final psychological break which snapped thousands of Nazi Party dignitaries out of their delusion, as reality and buildings started crumbling around them. As soon as the British and American bombs stopped falling, Berlin Defence Area Commander General Raymond's headquarters were swamped by thousands of Nazi Party officials, desperate to secure passes sanctioning their escape from Berlin. Without these passes, they would be forced to fight, as Goebbels had decreed that any man capable of bearing arms must stay in Berlin to defend the city against the incoming Red Army. General Raymond was all too happy to get these cowards out of the city, knowing that they would be of no use in the upcoming fighting. And in total, 2,000 exit passes were issued that day. As soon as the final Western Allied air raid on Berlin ended, the Soviets immediately started pumping artillery fire onto all parts of Berlin, raking the city's inhabitants with a murderous and indiscriminate barrage, which left a wave of death and destruction in its wake. This shelling was intended to cause terror amongst the civilian population, whilst at the same time demoralising and softening up the German garrison for the impending Soviet advance. The artillery barrage was immense and effective. Berliners had grown used to the regularity of the Allied air raids, the length and timing of which could be predicted. And they had even learned to listen out for the whistling of each falling bomb in order to determine approximately where it might land. But Berlin had not suffered such intense artillery fire before, and people had no time to react before thousands of shells started falling around them. Those who couldn't find shelter quickly enough were either blown apart by the incoming fire, or they were cut down by the shrapnel which pierced the air. The shelling had a catastrophic impact on the remaining infrastructure of the city, as what remained of Berlin's plumbing system was completely destroyed. Toilets stopped working, and in the city's densely packed shelters, which were now full to the brim, the people were forced to relieve themselves wherever they could, adding a new element of misery to their lives. Such was the intensity of the shelling that people now moved permanently to their nearest air raid shelter. And for the rest of the battle, the people of Berlin would only emerge from these shelters for brief moments to queue for food or scavenge for supplies. Whilst the strongest artillery fire was reserved for the central government quarter, with the Reichstag, Brandenburg Gate, Unter den Linden and the Stadtschloss all suffering direct hits, every part of the city, from Kudamm in the west through to Neukölln in the south, felt the wrath of the Red Army's guns. Hitler was apoplectic at the sight of Russian shells landing only metres from the Führerbunker itself, and he flew into one of his customary rages, demanding that the Luftwaffe locate the Soviet guns and destroy them. Luftwaffe Chief of Staff General Karl Koller diplomatically replied that the city's flak towers were already engaging the Soviet guns, but that they couldn't hope to destroy the thousands of guns the Red Army had. Moreover, any hope of Luftwaffe support from the sky was out of the question, as the nearest airfields were close to being overrun themselves. And even if the planes could take off, then swarms of enemy aircraft would surely shoot them down within minutes. With the Germans powerless to respond to the bombardment, the Soviets smelled blood. And once the barrage was over, Zhukov ordered his forces to advance. The Battle of Berlin had begun. From their positions in Bernau, Zhukov's forces, led by the 1st and 2nd Guards tank armies, advanced upon the city. And by late morning, the 2nd Guards tank army crossed the Autobahn ring to the northeast of Berlin. Here, the defense obstacles and the outer defense ring, which had been constructed in a last-minute rush to provide some protection to the outer districts of Berlin, were swept aside in minutes. And the weak Volkssturm and Luftwaffe detachments who manned those defences offered up a pretty shabby resistance before fleeing in panic, desperate to avoid being crushed by the incoming enemy tanks. With these measly outer defences crushed, the Soviet tanks were free to advance on Berlin along a broad front from Ahrensfelde and Hohenschönhausen in the northeast down to Kaulsdorf in the east of Berlin. By the evening, the 12th Guards Tank Corps from the 2nd Guards Tank Army had established firm positions in Hohenschönhausen, whilst the 1st Mechanized Corps, also from the 2nd Guards Tank Army, had reached Weißensee in the district of Pankow. Whilst Zhukov's forces were advancing rapidly in the northeast and east of the city, Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front forces were still driving quickly towards the south of Berlin. And by the evening of the 21st of April, scouts from Konev's 3rd Guards Tank Army reached the town of Königs Wusterhausen to the southeast of Berlin. Another notable byproduct of the Soviet advance on Berlin, and Zhukov's drive from the east in particular, was that General Weidling's 56th Panzer Corps became separated from its parent 9th Army. And thus, whilst the rest of the 9th Army was pushed into central Brandenburg, the 56th Panzer Corps had no option but to fall back towards Berlin. And by the end of the 21st of April, General Weidling's force had even been pushed all of the way back into the southeast of the city itself, into the district of Köpenick. The reason why the 56th Panzer Corps' movements are so important for our story is that from now on, this Panzer Corps will become inexorably linked with the fate of the capital. In the chaos of the hasty retreat, General Weidling lost contact both with General Busse from the 9th Army and with the German High Command. With no explanation as to where Weidling was, it looked as if the general had abandoned his orders to hold back the Russians, and was in fact retreating westwards in full flight to save his own skin. Rumours started flying around that General Weidling had been seen in Döberitz, a small village to the west of Berlin, and thus orders were issued by both Busse and Hitler for General Weidling's execution. This wasn't true, of course, but it serves as another fine example of how the lack of communication and reliable information on the battlefield was leading to unnecessary sideshows and distractions just at the time when the Germans needed to be pulling their socks up to defend Berlin. In the daily war conference held that afternoon in the Führerbunker, the atmosphere was turning increasingly fatalistic as report after report came through, outlining the collapse of German forces in the face of the rapid Soviet advances. Suddenly, in and amongst all of the depressing reports of German retreats, Hitler cast his eye over the situation map and spotted the name Steiner. Hitler perhaps remembering how General Felix Steiner had led a successful counterattack against Soviet forces in Pomerania in February of 1945, quickly latched onto the name and placed his hopes on the man, identifying him as the savior of Berlin. Hitler started formulating a half-cocked fantasy whereby the grandiose army detachment Steiner, striking from the town of Eberswalde, 30 kilometers northeast of Berlin, would launch a counterattack on the right flank of the First Belarusian Front. This attack, Hitler explained, was to be launched in combination with a strike northwards from the remaining forces of the German 9th Army, currently positioned to the southeast of Berlin. Hitler's plan, therefore, was for these two German pincers to cut off the head of Zhukov's First Belarusian Front. The room was stunned by Hitler's suggestion, for the assembled generals knew the bitter truth. Steiner's forces were woefully undermanned for what was being asked of them, because Steiner was in command of only 3 battalions, which is a few thousand men, and he only had a handful of tanks. The idea that he could take on an entire Red Army front, totaling hundreds of thousands of men, backed up by thousands of guns and tanks, was insane. But whether out of fear or loyalty, the generals in the Führerbunker allowed Hitler's fantasy to run rampant, and they assured him that his plan was workable if Steiner was strengthened with reinforcements first, however. Ironically, before the Soviets launched Operation Berlin, Steiner had possessed a sizable force, as he had commanded the 3rd Germanic SS Panzer Corps, which acted as a reserve corps for Army Group Vistula. This Panzer Corps had been composed mainly of foreign SS volunteer units who were battle-hardened and highly motivated, plus they had been given a strong complement of tanks and armoured vehicles. However, once the Red Army launched its assault on the Zelower Heights, General Heinrici, commander of Army Group Vistula, had stripped Steiner of his strongest units, and he had transferred them to General Busse's 9th Army. These redeployments, however, had left Steiner with a depleted force, and thus Heinrici, recognizing Steiner's reduced status, ordered Steiner to concentrate his remaining forces in the Eberswalde area. The best they could do was act as a screening force, protecting the right flank of 3rd Panzer Army way up in the north of Brandenburg and Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. The blunt truth, however, was that Steiner's scratch force couldn't do much of anything, and no one in their right mind could have expected Steiner's force to play a role in the defence of Berlin. But despite that, Steiner's group existed on a little flag on Hitler's situation map. So as he scrambled around for forces, any forces, which could save Berlin, he jabbed his finger into the map and repeatedly screamed, "Steiner, Steiner, Steiner!" And thus, the die was cast. Steiner and his motley crew of units were now being ordered by the Führer to launch a massive counterattack against Zhukov's entire First Belarusian Front. In the evening, Hitler called Steiner directly from the Führerbunker, and he informed him of his plan. Steiner tried in vain to argue that he didn't have enough troops at his disposal, to which Hitler boldly claimed that every available man between Berlin and the Baltic Sea was being sent to reinforce his attack. Unimpressed, Steiner tried pressing his case, and he asked Hitler exactly where the attack was meant to take place. Hitler responded by hanging up on him. Steiner then rang General Krebs at OKH to plead with him that his forces were simply too small to launch the immense counterattack being demanded of them by the Führer. But Hitler cut in on the call and informed Steiner that his forces would surely deliver a great victory over the Russians at the gates of Berlin. Soon afterwards, Steiner received the official order, in which a foreboding threat was outlined, stating, "It is expressly forbidden to fall back to the West. Officers who do not comply unconditionally with this order, are to be arrested and shot right away. You, Steiner, are liable with your head for the execution of this order. The fate of the Reich capital depends on the success of your mission. However, as alarming as this threat was, threats alone were not going to conjure up the divisions Steiner needed to make a successful counterattack. So the Führerbunker went into action mode, trying to scrounge up reinforcements for Steiner's attack. For instance, Hitler immediately placed a call to General Karl Koller of the Luftwaffe, and in the call, he demanded that all Air Force personnel in the northern zone who can be made available are to be placed at the disposal of Steiner and brought to him, and that any commanding officer who keeps back personnel will forfeit his life within 5 hours. Hitler then helpfully screamed, "You yourself will guarantee with your own head that absolutely every man is assembled." Koller was dumbfounded, and as soon as Hitler ended the call, Koller called OKH to ask them exactly where Steiner was, because he didn't even know where to send his Luftwaffe personnel. Eventually, Heinrici, who is Army Group Vistula commander after all, heard of Hitler's order to Steiner, and when he did, he urgently called Krebs to clarify the situation. Heinrici argued that Steiner possessed neither the size nor strength of forces required to launch a counterattack, and he begged for a private meeting with Hitler to, diplomatically, impress upon him the lunacy of his plan. General Krebs refused this request, saying that Hitler was, quote-unquote, overworked. All of this madness just goes to show that as the Russians were advancing through the northeastern districts of Berlin, the German military leadership was paralysed by Hitler's drug-fueled visions of phantom German counterattacks, which supposedly would save Berlin from annihilation. The whole business with Steiner's counterattack was an unnecessary distraction, which led to confusion within the higher echelons of the German military leadership. Plus, the threats of summary execution forced the generals to play along with Hitler's fantasy, even when everyone knew that Steiner's attack, even if it could be launched, would be doomed to failure anyway. In any case, to show just how mad the German command situation was, all branches of the military were ordered to find any available men to bolster Steiner's force. The Luftwaffe pledged 12,000 to 15,000 men from the ground services in northern Germany, whilst other units were hastily formed from cadets, the Berlin Fire Brigade, the Berlin Police, the Volkssturm, and even prison convicts. Overnight, the manpower equivalent of around 1.5 divisions was raised. But this mishmash of units lacked the necessary training, cohesion, communications, heavy arms, or equipment needed to have any meaningful impact on the battlefield. Once the units were identified, the only task that remained was to transport them to Steiner's position. But Steiner's exact position was unknown to the generals in Berlin. Eventually, Steiner was located at Oranienburg, to the north of Berlin, and the hastily assembled forces were sent there to link up with Steiner. But these efforts were pointless, because the deployment of 1.5 divisions worth of quote-unquote troops was not going to strengthen Steiner's force sufficiently enough to halt the advance of Zhukov's first Belarusian front. Only the injection of a few hundred thousand men, planes, tanks, and guns might have had any impact. But once again, reality mattered little to Hitler and his senior generals. Hitler had snapped his fingers and demanded the creation of a counter-attacking force, so the generals moved mountains to make this happen. The upshot of all of this was that these hastily assembled units were sent north of Berlin on a wild goose chase, to link up with Steiner's forces, who are never going to launch a counterattack anyway. And this 1.5 divisions worth of men could have been put to much better use bolstering the defences within Berlin. If you thought that was enough chaos for one day within German High Command, then think again. Because in the late hours of the 21st of April, Hitler decided to dismiss General Raymond from his position as commander of the Berlin Defence Area. The reasons why Hitler did this are unclear. It seems Hitler had a personal dislike of the man, whilst Raymond was also the victim of backstabbing from Hitler's inner circle, as Goebbels also disliked Raymond because he had committed the crime of not moving his headquarters next to Goebbels' headquarters in the bunker at Zoo. Whatever the real reason, Raymond was stripped of his title and he was reassigned to become the commander of a weak division of garrison troops defending Potsdam instead. Ironically, this demotion ended up saving Raymond's life, as his new garrison would eventually break out from Potsdam and successfully link up with General Wenck's 12th Army before crossing into American-held territory over the River Elbe. But we'll get to Wenck later, so let's not spoil that part of the story just yet. Numerous replacements for the commander of the Berlin Defence Area were considered and rejected by Hitler, before he opted to promote the obscure Colonel Keitel to the role. Keitel possessed no significant military experience for the task, and his main qualification seems to be that he was a Nazi loyalist, who had served as the regime's National Socialist Führungsoffizier, a position akin to the Soviet military commissar. Keitel was quickly promoted to Major General and then to Lieutenant General, but his appointment as Berlin Defence Area Commander was abruptly cancelled the next day on the 22nd of April. Exactly why this promotion was cancelled is unknown to history, but it was likely due to the fact that even at this late stage of the war, Hitler's madness knew some limits, as it became clear, even to him, that this obscure colonel was not fit to lead the defence of the capital. In any case, the outcome of all of this hiring and firing was that Berlin was without a commander, just as the Red Army was advancing through the northern and eastern districts of the city.